So let's think about, where do we begin? We begin with the, really, and we think about the church with the apostles. Peter and the 12. So what are apostles? In Luke 6, Luke says, Jesus chose 12 and named them apostles. Named them apostles, a Greek word that means one who is sent. But it means ambassadors. It means people that carry authority and speak on behalf of the one that they represent. So this is different than angels, heralds, who take an announcement. An apostle is a person that is empowered in a way that a herald is not. A herald, a courier, brings a message. They tell you something. They bring something from the person. But they're not empowered to say anything or do anything on behalf of the person that they represent. An apostle is a person that is empowered to speak on behalf of the person that they have been commissioned by. And so the apostles are commissioned with people who can say something. They are supposed to, they are responsible for laying the foundations of the church. They are responsible to set an example. They are responsible to settle disputes. They are responsible to found churches, to appoint elders. They are entrusted with this gospel as a trust. They are given this gospel in trust to carry. And Jesus spoke probably mostly in Aramaic, not in Greek. The Aramaic term that goes with the word that we get apostle from is a term that was widely used at the time as a meaning for somebody who was an empowered representative in the culture. And there were quite a few rabbis, traveling preachers, who designated somebody, one or more people, as to have this role, to speak on their behalf. And particularly as people got older, they would find a younger person that they would train up in the things that they taught and believed, and they would designate them in this way, to speak on their behalf, to speak for them. So when Jesus chooses 12, we're going to speak on his behalf, and we're going to found his church. He goes and picks the 12 most qualified men that he can find, right? No, I mean, MacArthur's book, 12 Ordinary Men, which might be a little strong. when you start thinking about these guys, the knucklehead factor is not trivial here, okay? As is true with many of us. But when you think about this, hey, I'm going to pull 12 guys together and appoint them to be my representatives, and so I'm going to start by picking 4 fishermen from Galilee whose education probably stopped when they were 13 or 14 years old. That's going to be my core. And oh, by the way, as I think about this, I'm thinking about these 4 fishermen. This is my starting point, right? When you see there are 4 lists of the 12, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and Acts, okay? I put them up here in these 3 groups because they're always in these 3 groups, okay? Across those 4 different lists, they're in different order, but they're always in these 3 groups. These 4 fishermen are always the first 4 on the list. And Peter is always first. And Philip is always 5th. That is, he is always listed first of the next 4. Bartholomew, or who's also known as Nathaniel, Matthew, and Thomas are the other 3 who always go with Philip. And James, the son of Alphaeus, is always the guy that leads off the last 4. Always, always. He's always 9th on the list. Thaddeus, who is known in two of those lists as Judas, son of James, Simon the Zealot, those two guys, you can swap the order, okay? Twice Thaddeus is listed first, and twice Simon is listed first, okay? Judas Iscariot, always last. And typically labeled the traitor. So we have, Jesus picked 12 guys, but they weren't 12 together. They were really three groups of four. And each of the three groups of four seems to have had a leader. Because each of the three groups of four, when they're listed, the same guy is at the head of the list. And there seems to have been some precedence here. Three guys who go to the Transfiguration, they're all three from this first group of four. Three guys are called to pray with Jesus in Gethsemane, they're all from this first group of four. So, and you get some interaction with this second group. What do you hear from this group of four in the Gospels? Almost nothing, right? What does this last group of four do in Acts? When you plug Matthias in for Judas Iscariot. They're almost not part of the story. So Jesus picks this, you know, with the core group being fishermen. We don't know what a lot of these other guys do. We know two people, though. Maybe this is why they're not in the same group. Matthew, tax collector, works for the Romans. He's regarded as a traitor by most Jews, right? Okay? He's a tool of the occupying authority. Simon the Zealot. What does it mean to be a zealot? Zealots are revolutionaries. Okay? Zealots want to cast the Romans out. A significant portion of the zealots were Sicarii, the guys with the knives, who wandered around in the crowds in Jerusalem and stabbed people that they didn't like. Because, you know, in the crush of people, it was relatively easy to get away. So, Matthew and Simon the Zealot, there's no reason to believe that those two guys could ever get along. Simon would see Matthew as a guy who was well worth killing. Okay? And Matthew would see Simon as a dangerous criminal. But Jesus called them both, and they served together. Not in the same group of four, apparently, but they did serve together. But Jesus picked an unlikely group. He picked a group that had within it the seeds of serious internal conflict. And it's not clear that there's anybody in this group that was particularly educated beyond the basics of the synagogue school. So 12 ordinary men indeed, but 12 men that, you know, from the standpoint of I'm starting a world-changing thing here, these 12 guys are not obvious choices at all. You don't get much leverage out of these guys. These guys don't know anybody. They don't apparently have much in the way of resources. All the evidence that we have about Peter's house in Capernaum indicates that it was in a relatively poorer section of a relatively poor town. So the fishing business was probably not paying off big. So James and John, you know, their father had enough going on that he could hire some helpers, but that certainly doesn't seem to have made them wealthy in any way. So these 12 guys, interesting choices. Apostles later on, you know, what is an apostle? The definition that we're given later on is that somebody who saw Jesus, who is personally been exposed to Jesus in his teaching and has been faithful in in this ministry, in this work along the way. That's basically the criteria that they used to pick Matthias in Acts chapter 1 to replace Judas. But the apostles found responsible for laying this foundation of the church. They called out ones and engaged in some kind of pioneering ministry. So why 12? 12 tribes. 12 is hugely symbolic for Jews. So because Jesus could have easily picked 8 or 10 or 14, 15, but he picked 12, and he almost certainly picked 12 because 12 is hugely symbolic to Jews. John MacArthur in his book suggests that this is actually maybe a judgment on the apostasy of Israel, that he picks 12 to kind of symbolize that I'm sort of replacing the 12 tribal leaders, the 12 tribes. I'm doing a new thing. I'm doing a new 12. So this may or may not be true, but it's new in that sense. It's new leadership for a new covenant. But 12 is significant in some Jewish ways. So we know some other things about these guys as apostles. It seems that they did not, after the ascension, that they did not remain long in Jerusalem. That is, a decade or 15 years on, they were not all still there. That they went out. Eusebius, in his ecclesiastical history, says they divided up the world among them and went out in different directions. The actual evidence for that's a little sketchy, but it's possible. So one of the things that we have to come face to face with is when there's the Jerusalem Council in Acts chapter 15, who seems to be running the council? Who speaks in the council in Acts chapter 15 and is listened to by everyone and everyone agrees, ceding leadership authority to that person? It's not any of the 12. It's James the Just, James the brother of Jesus. And who does Paul report to when a couple of decades on he returns to Jerusalem around 60 AD and is arrested after the riot in the temple? He's bringing the gifts, the offerings from the churches of Achaia and Macedonia and elsewhere that he has collected as a gift to the church at Jerusalem to help them in their poverty because of all the things that happened at the beginning of Acts. Who does he give that to? Not one of the 12. It's James the Just, the brother of Jesus. Who does he report to and tell about, who kind of chairs the meeting where Paul reports in on his missionary work across Asia Minor and Macedonia and Achaia? It's James the Just, not one of the 12. And so there's reasons to think that these 12 guys did not linger for a long period of time in Jerusalem, but that they went forth, that they saw their job as not staying in this place, but going out. And since Acts fairly soon, locks in on Paul, by the time you're halfway through Acts, you're in Paul's story and you get very little about anybody else. We don't know what other people did. But we do have some sense that Peter, at least, was moving, was on the move, was going places. So of these 12, only Peter really has a very major role in Acts. And Luke does not record where the others went or what they did. So we have some tradition, some minor evidence. I'm going to run through some of that about where they went and what they did, just to give you a sense of that. But of these 12, only one of them died a natural death, right? We can be confident that only John died of old age. So we are certain we know how James, the brother of John, the son of Zebedee, was executed for the faith. He was martyred. We know some of the details of that and when that happened. We think we know quite a bit about what happened to Peter. We know less about the others, but by tradition, all 11 except for John were martyred for the faith. And there's no reason to doubt that that's true, really. There's no counter evidence that says, no, no, one of these guys actually lived to a great age. If you have the opportunity, I would really recommend that you go to Ephesus. It's a great tour, great place to visit, great place to walk. You can walk the streets and you can sit in the big amphitheater where the riot happened and where Paul wanted to get out on the stage and they wouldn't let him. You can go and see stuff. And of course, if you go there, they'll invite you to go up on the hill overlooking the ancient town to visit the House of Mary. It's a big tourist attraction. I mean, it's not a big place, but it is a place that people that go to Ephesus routinely go up the hill to see the House of Mary. So I went up the hill to see the House of Mary. At the crucifixion, Jesus, famously told John to care for his mother, right? Which is interesting because she had four other sons. But he tells John, the disciple that he loved, to care for his mom. Well, the tradition in Ephesus is that John, having come to Ephesus, and we can be pretty strong that John did go to Ephesus, right? Because he writes the Revelation from Patmos, which is a small rocky island in the Aegean, which was used to exile people from the city of Ephesus when they crossed the line and did stuff that the local authority did not approve of. Patmos is not very far off the coast, and it's not even, 20 miles or something from Ephesus. Patmos is close. I think from Patmos you can see the coast. I think it's only 3 or 4 miles or something. I mean, it's not far off the coast. It's not way out. But the city of Ephesus at the time used Patmos as a place of exile. If you were causing trouble in the city, or if you were the source of trouble in the city, they sent you to Patmos to get you out of town. Patmos was a rocky nowhere that wasn't that far away. It was fairly convenient, and it was a lot cheaper than building some kind of jail and trying to figure out how to keep people in it. They just dropped them off on Patmos and then went and picked them up if they decided that, maybe it was okay. So John's revelation is written on Patmos. He is walking on Patmos and praying, and he says, I see these visions, all this, and I write this all down. So that's a strong connection to the city of Ephesus, and there's a lot of local tradition at Ephesus that John came there. There is a lot of the church fathers make reference to John as being associated with the church at the city of Ephesus. The local tradition says that John, as a very elderly man, was no longer able to walk, and so he sat in a chair, and on the Sabbath, young men from the church would go to where John was living and pick him up in the chair and carry him through the streets to meet for the worship together, and then carry him in his chair back home. In any case, Mary's house up on the hill was built in the 1950s, I checked. But it is built on the ruins of an older house that was built maybe in the 1300s or 1400s, and that's built on the ruins of a much older house. So there was a house at that location, which is kind of a catch the sea breeze, overlook the city, get away from sort of the smells and immediate difficulty. It's really kind of a nice spot. And, you know, if you're going to be a retired lady that lots of people come to see, it's a pretty good choice. But we don't know very much about where these guys went or what they did. And so, but we know that they were called to go. We know that they were entrusted with this gospel, and that they were, as apostles, that they were given power to speak on behalf. And that some of them did miraculous things. Maybe all of them. Almost all of them, there is some tradition that goes with basically all these guys, and that tradition almost always includes the performing of some kind of miracles in the places that they went. So, so let's think about apostles in a little bit larger sense here. So you get Peter and the 12. No dispute, Jesus named them apostles. So we get Paul. Paul says, I am an apostle. Paul defends his apostleship when he's writing to the Corinthians. Okay? In Romans 1:15, he talks about how he received this apostleship. Okay, in 1 Corinthians 9, he talks about how this apostleship has been sealed upon him. In 1 Corinthians 15, he talks about, I'm the least of the apostles because I was the great persecutor of the church. But Paul, at the beginning of most of his letters, says, Paul, an apostle. So Paul actively claims the title of apostle, and he came face to face with Jesus on the road to Damascus, and therefore he has a basis for saying, I have been called and appointed to this role by the Lord himself, face to face. And he was affirmed by the others, right? The others accepted him in this way. And so he is affirmed by the other apostles. We've got Paul matters, of course, because he lives at this intersection of the big threads that we talked about. The Jewish culture. Paul is a son of a Pharisee. He's a member of the tribe of Benjamin. He knows his tribal descent. He is part of the most serious party with respect to respect for the Old Testament, respect for the Word of God, respect for the law. He is part of that. He is trained in one of the greatest Jewish schools of the day. As a child, maybe at 10 or 11, or maybe even a little earlier than that, he was sent from Tarsus, where he was born and raised, and where he went to the synagogue school, and where he was clearly one of the top students, maybe the top student. He was sent to Jerusalem, to the school of Gamaliel. And the school of Gamaliel was the most famous school. It wasn't necessarily the most popular school at that time, but the school of Gamaliel's grandfather, Hillel, had been the greatest teacher of the age, really in the kind of the previous century. Hillel lived to be over 100 years old and was regarded as the great Jewish teacher of the period under Herod the Great and the time that Jesus is born. The school of Hillel is the great school, and Hillel is an elderly man at that time. Gamaliel, his grandson, inherits the school when Hillel dies. Paul, as a boy, is sent to the school of Gamaliel. The school of Gamaliel, by reputation, is different than the other schools. Gamaliel was reputed to be a very gentle, thoughtful, super big brain kind of a guy. And so some of the other schools that competed, there were a variety of Jewish schools, were fairly abusive. And apparently the school of Gamaliel was not very much like that. And so Paul goes and graduates from the school of Gamaliel as one of the top students there. And so so he's got the Jewish thing. But along the way, he has grown up in the Greek culture, and he has become familiar along the way with Greek poetry and philosophy. When he goes to the Areopagus in Athens, he quotes from things that the Areopagites would know. And it doesn't seem like, you know, he went out and said, hey, what do these guys know? What's a couple of quotes I could use? It seems like it's really stuff that he knows. And he writes to Titus about the work on Crete. He quotes Cretan sources. He quotes the most famous poet from Crete in writing to Titus and telling him how to deal with the people of Crete. So Paul has broadened his education somehow. He's picked up a lot of Greek. He speaks Greek very well. And he's educated in the Greek thing. And then Roman. His name, Paulus, is probably the third name in a sequence of three, which was a standard Roman practice. And the first two names would be family names, and then Paulus at the end would be the name that by which he was addressed in the Roman tradition. Saul being the Jewish name that he was probably given when he was circumcised on the eighth day, as per the law. His parents were rigorous about these things. And so he is known as Saul in the family and among the Jews, but he is known as Paul to any outsiders from the very beginning. And so he starts to use the name Paul when he becomes the apostle to the Gentiles, because that's the name that he has always used in dealing with Romans, in dealing with Greek-speaking people. And he uses Saul when he is aspiring to be part of the Sanhedrin. So, and of course, he, you know, because he is this intersection of Jew and Greek and Roman, he can cross every border and engage every person. There is really nobody that he cannot talk to, because he knows how to talk to all the people that he meets. He understands how to engage in their culture, how they speak, how they think. And so wherever he goes, he can preach in the synagogue, he can preach in the street, and it's not the same, because it's different people, different ways of thinking. And you can go to the Areopagus and argue a little philosophy. It's different. So Paul brings all those things. He's a really educated man in a way that the 12 are not. And of course, Paul brings controversy almost every place he goes. I mean, one of my favorite things about Paul is, you know, Paul becomes a Christian, and he's at Damascus, and he's preaching, and it becomes such a big deal that they lower him down in a basket, you know, out of a hole in the wall, so that he can escape in the dark of night and not be murdered. And so he goes to Jerusalem, and he's winning all the arguments in the synagogues and in the streets, arguing with all these people about the gospel. And it creates this great uproar, and people are trying to kill him. And so the rest of the apostles get together and ship him out of town. You know, send him down to Caesarea and off back home to Tarsus. And what's the comment that Luke puts immediately after that in Acts? And the church had peace. That's my favorite comment about Paul. Right there. You send Paul into exile, and the church has peace. So it's only when Barnabas gets sent by the apostles in Jerusalem to go to Antioch to see what's going on, and finds out that there's a revival going on and the church is growing there, Barnabas doesn't turn around and go back to Jerusalem and say, I need some help. Barnabas decides it's not that far to Tarsus. I'm going to go there and track down that Paul guy, and finds him probably making tents, which was his family business. So Anyway, but Paul is known for going places and then writing letters and doing follow-up visits, and his ongoing ministry of prayer for the churches and his conviction that the gospel needs to go to Rome. James the Just. James is the brother of Jesus, the writer of the Epistle of James, and becomes the leader of the church at Jerusalem. He's the guy that seems to have chaired the Jerusalem Council in Acts chapter 15. He's the guy that Paul reports into when he comes back to Jerusalem with the gift. He's the guy that Paul engages with when he returns. And Paul, in writing about Jerusalem, says, you know, I talked to the guys who seem to be pillars, he says. And pillars, he lists James as one of them. So James, of course, as a brother of Jesus, during Jesus' life and ministry, how does James respond? What's the thing that we know? That Jesus is preaching and teaching, and he's in the house, maybe at Capernaum, and they say, your mother and your brothers are outside, and they think maybe you've lost your mind, and they're here to take you home and protect you and help you, right? So James seems to be a person that did not come to the faith until very late. He is not listed, immediately as a person of significance until after the resurrection. But he becomes the decider in Jerusalem. So, what about Barnabas? Is Barnabas an apostle? In Acts 14, it says, the apostles Barnabas and Paul were sent. So, Barnabas is sent from Jerusalem. There's ancient tradition that says he must have been one of the 70 that Luke says Jesus sent out to preach and teach. There's no list of the 70 anywhere and no ability to know whether that is true. But Barnabas is sent from Jerusalem up to Antioch when they hear that the church is growing, and it is growing as a multicultural church where both Jews and Greeks are in the same congregation together. Antioch is a multicultural city. It has a big Jewish community, but it's a primarily Greek city. It's on the main route between East and West. It's an important pivot point, an important point for the sake of the gospel. You know, what do we know about Barnabas? We know that he was a Jew, that he was a Levite, that he was of the tribe of Levi. He might have been a priest. We know that he was the uncle of John Mark. And we know that he was a man of at least some means. In Acts chapter 4, he sells a piece of property that he owns and brings the whole proceeds and gives it to the apostle for the use of the church. And so, clearly the property was not the only thing that he owned in the world. So he was a man of at least some means. So we do know that Barnabas is listed at least once as an apostle, but we don't know how does he meet the requirement to have had some face-to-face with Jesus, have been personally able to personally testify to this. We don't know that. That's one of the reasons, right, traditionally people have wanted to make Barnabas one of the 70, because it makes it easy to say, oh, well, you know, he's a witness. Matthias is one of the 70, and so they picked one of the 70 to replace Judas Iscariot, so maybe others of the 70 would be qualified as well. But we don't know whether Barnabas meets that qualification or not. So, but Barnabas is referred to as an apostle and has traditionally been thought of in the church since then as an apostle. What about Silas? When Paul and Barnabas bust up over the issue of John Mark's future in his general unworthiness for the sake of the gospel, at least in Paul's mind, because he's flaked out on him twice and run home to his mom. Barnabas takes John Mark on his sort of rehabilitation task and goes back to Cyprus, where he's originally from, to invest in the church there. And Paul takes Silas. And Silas is listed as a leader in the church. Silas, of course, is the co-author of the two letters to the Thessalonian church. Paul and Silas. Paul and Silvanus. Silvanus is a Roman name. Silas is a Jewish name and might have been a nickname. But it's pretty clear that the guy that Luke always refers to as Silas and Paul always refers to as Silvanus are the same guy. So Silas may be a nickname that allows him to travel or engage in some way. But he does show up briefly in Acts and also he's in 2 Corinthians. But we don't know. There are some people that think that he belongs on the list of the apostles. But there's nothing biblical that really allows us to say that. Paul lists other people as co-authors of his letters a fair amount. And so that alone is not the basis of apostleship. Timothy is listed as a co-author on some of his letters, for instance. So, and then there's Apollos. Apollos is a traveling preacher. Luke says in Acts, Apollos, is a very Roman name, right? A name for a Roman god. But Luke says in Acts that Paul was that Apollos was a Jew from Alexandria. So Luke says he was Jewish. Apollos is not a Jewish name. And he was from Alexandria, which was a very Greek city that had a fairly large Jewish population, but the Jews lived together. It had a Jewish quarter. But it was a largely Greek city. So Apollos seems to be a guy who had some crossing the various cultural boundaries thing going here. He becomes a traveling preacher. He becomes a major figure in the church at Corinth. At the beginning of 1 Corinthians, when Paul talks about the church at Corinth, he says the church at Corinth is divided into three parties. There's people that say that I am of Paul. There's people that say I'm of Cephas or Peter. And there are people that say I am of Apollos. And so you see that there are people in Corinth who see Apollos as being basically on a level with Peter and Paul. If for nothing else, because he's a great preacher. And Paul says, I planted, Apollos watered, and God gave the growth. In 1 Corinthians 3, he also says, Apollos is my fellow worker. And in 1 Corinthians 4, for verse 9, he says, he talks about us apostles. We as apostles. Well, three verses prior, the guy he was talking about was Apollos. And at the end of chapter 2, the three people he's talking about are Paul and Peter and Apollos. So when he says us apostles in 1 Corinthians 4, 9, it seems to point back to Apollos, as well as maybe Peter. It's possible that the word had changed some, but not a lot of time has passed, less than 20 years probably. Hard to see that the term has moved. And it was a really important term in the early church. This idea of apostolic authority was very important in the early church. So it's unlikely, because Paul is so focused on making the case that he is an apostle. That's a theme that is in several of his letters. This is a really important term to Paul, and likely the one that he does not use lightly. So when he uses us apostles, who does he actually go about with, who is also an apostle? You know, this is after the breakup with Barnabas, and you know, it's apparent that they really didn't get back together and go on the road any further. Barnabas is associated with the work in Cyprus after that time, primarily. And Paul and Peter do not seem to have traveled together at any point. They encountered one another, and they both had a mark on the church at Corinth. So there, and Paul does this really interesting thing. You know, in writing the Corinthians, he says, "I've asked Apollos to come to you, but it was not his will to come to you at this time." So Apollos was a guy who felt free to tell Paul no. So Apollos seemed to think that he and Paul had some equality and that Paul was not above him in the food chain in some significant way because he was willing to say, "No, I'm not going to do that." And later on, Paul says, "Look, you know, Apollos will come to you, speed him on his way. Care for his every need. Do whatever it takes to allow him to go where he needs to go." So Paul speaks about Apollos in a way that is very respectful. And so Apollos is kind of a maybe here too. But we also see one other thing about apostles that's important is, you know, this first church council in Acts chapter 15, there is a strong sense that there are certain men who have been given this role, and they are the men who are responsible to make the difficult decisions that had been placed on them. This is your responsibility. This is on you. You must take this burden and carry it. And I think that's really consistent with, you know, the way that I understand the Bible about men and women. I see, you know, the Bible, I think, is very positive towards women in super countercultural ways for the New Testament era. You know, I went through the list of the women that Jesus dealt with. And almost all the women that Jesus dealt with in the gospel are women that other preachers and teachers of the day would have had nothing to do with. They would have refused to meet with them. They would have refused to even talk to them. You know, Samaritan, Syrophoenician, a woman who has a flow of blood that has made her ritually unclean for years. You know, those kinds of people are people that preachers and teachers of the day would have absolutely refused to have anything to do with. And yet Jesus engages them and cares for them and cares about them and affirms them and takes them very, very seriously, treats them as people who matter, really countercultural. And so, you know, down through the ages, and we'll talk about this more later, you know, men have looked at things that the Bible says about what men are supposed to do and have used that to kind of push women down and say, you know, "I'm in charge here, the Bible puts me in charge," kind of stuff. But you know, my take on that has always been, you know, the Bible tells men, you're responsible. And that's not the same as being in charge. That doesn't give you authority to say, "Go do what I want you to do." That gives you responsibility. Responsibility to lead. Responsibility to do hard things. Responsibility to stand up. Responsibility to go forward. And in the same way, the apostles have taken on, they've been given responsibility to do hard things. When there is a hard thing to do in the church, the apostles are supposed to do it. When there's a hard decision, when there's a hard dispute, they are supposed to do it. This is their responsibility. And so this is less about, you know, giving them power so that they could lord it over. What did Jesus say? You know, not like the Gentiles lording it over. If you would be first, be last, be a servant of all. And so the apostles don't come as people to be served. They come as Jesus did, as people to serve. And they come as people to serve. And part of the service is to do the hard things. to face off against the hard issues, to deal with the hard problems, to make the hard decisions, to do the difficult things. This is their responsibility. So, and then one other thing about Apollos, by the way, in 2 Corinthians, Paul keeps talking about the famous preacher and never says the famous preacher's name, which might be because Apollos had become such a famous preacher that nobody needed to say his name anymore. But Paul is clearly referring to somebody in particular, and he is assuming that when he says the famous preacher will come, that they know who that person is, that he knows and they know. And so those could be references to Apollos. So this comes from a catacomb which is under an office building in Rome. It dates from the second half of the 4th century. And it's the earliest image that we know of that has Peter and Paul together in the same image. So this is second half of the 4th century, sometime between 350 and 400 AD. This is iconic kinds of stuff. People created icons, and we'll talk more about this later as this becomes more and more controversial in the life of the church. But early on, they created images so that people would have something to look at and kind of relate to. And then later, this becomes controversial because these sorts of images become points of reverence and then potentially points of worship. And so, iconoclasm, of course, is smashing icons for the sake of releasing people from worshiping that which is not what we should worship, in violation of the first commandment. But this is a catacomb, a tomb, and these images are from the ceiling. And I wanted to point out to you that these are very consistent with the earliest images that we have of these two guys. Peter in this image is only, fractionally taller. Typically, he is depicted as significantly taller than Paul when they are depicted together. But Peter is invariably depicted with a full head of hair, and Paul is invariably not. Okay? Peter is depicted with a beard always, and so is Paul, but Paul's beard is usually longer. Peter's beard is usually, up around his face here, and Paul's beard has some length almost always. And Paul always has the big forehead, and often with sort of the worry lines across it. So Paul is usually the guy that looks a lot more worried than Peter. But these two guys are given these two people's images. In the early imagery, these two are given primacy of place from the 3rd century at least on, and potentially earlier than that. Because, when you get an image like this, this is from, 380 or something around that time. That's 300 years after these two guys were executed. And that's a long time. But it's a long time in a culture that has a very strong oral history tradition. Storytelling, vivid storytelling, telling stories in ways that people can see it in their minds is fundamental to the culture. And so people learn, because there was no photography, learn to describe other people in vivid ways. So we have some pretty vivid descriptions. John Chrysostom, the golden-tongued, who was preaching in Constantinople at around the time that this image was made in Rome, preached that Paul was, quote, short, crooked, and bald, unquote. So that's from the Golden Tongue. There's apocryphal texts, one called Acts of Paul and one called the Acts of St. Peter. Both of those ancient writers, and we don't know who the writers are, and those are non-biblical, non-inspired texts, but both of them agree about Paul, that he was short and kind of bandy-legged and bald and intense, which you ought to be able to get out of his writing. So there's a bunch of ancient writers that call Paul the man of three cubits. If that's true, he was about 4'6". Okay? Which might be why it is that he says in one of his letters, people say that I write powerful stuff, but I'm not powerful when I come in person. And if he really was 4'6", in an era when pretty much nobody was 6 feet tall, okay? So people were, you know, much less well-fed, much less nutrition, much less medical care. So short was the order of the day, but 4'6" would have been short even for then. And there is no there is no controversy about whether Paul was short. So, and that Peter was not. So we have tradition that comes down from the very earliest writings that is very consistent with imagery that happens very early on. So, and I put these images up because they're pretty consistent. Images that you get, that we find in Constantinople that were done around the same time, look a lot like this. And it's really unlikely that the artist had been to Rome to see this before making the image in Constantinople. So we see images from various locations, and yet the people look pretty consistently the same. So the descriptions were very consistent, the oral history very consistent down through the years. So, yeah, it's possible that there were very early images made and that later artists used that as a basis. You know, what we do know is the art that has lasted, which is mostly in tombs, and really nothing from earlier than the second century, but the art which has lasted here's an early thing from Constantinople. It's been rehabbed some over the years, but this is an image of Peter. Once again, full head of hair. He's gray, so this is old Peter, but basically the same beard. And you can tell it's Peter because he has the keys. You know, I've given you the keys to the kingdom. So that became an imagery associated with him. But this is a very early image of Peter. And here's the very earliest image of Paul from Ephesus. This is from a grotto in Ephesus. But once again, you know, balding, big forehead, bags under his eyes, long beard. Yeah, it's got a cross, and you know, it looks like might actually be reversed maybe. Which is an interesting thing because you would normally associate that image with Peter and not with Paul. These early images have a lot of consistency. Interestingly, because you know you've got Constantinople, you've got Ephesus, you've got Rome, you've got artists working in very different places, and most of the public art that was from early on we don't have. It was destroyed. At one point or another, either by persecution or by natural causes, we do see very consistently grave kinds of stuff. All this stuff comes out of grottos and catacombs and that sort of stuff. That's how stuff gets preserved for most of two millennia. It's out of the weather and out of the public eye, but these images are really quite consistent about what did they look like, which is, you know, interesting. But it is also testament to consistency down through the ages about the people that are telling the story. So anyway, but the art is highly symbolic. The art is significant in terms of showing us things that people believe to be true. And so the art, you know, art in those early ages was not intended to be photography. It was intended to give you an image that would stick with you and that would teach you something.